Good morning, everyone, committee members and others. Thank you for being here. I'd like to call to order the meeting of Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development for today, Monday, I think the 24th of February. Yes. We've got two things on our schedule this morning. We're going to have a work session on Senate Bill 1525A as follow-up to the public hearing, which we began on Friday morning. And then we will have an informational hearing on the HEC strategic plan. And we've got a couple of rock stars coming in to talk to us about that. I would like to begin by opening a work session on Senate Bill 1525A. And do you want to talk about this? Victoria, cue us in a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1525A, which we discussed last week, grants Higher Education Coordinating Commission authority to enter into and administer interstate agreements regarding provision of post-secondary distance education, clarifies the relationships between the HEC and Oregon Education Investment Board, revises the composition of the State Board of Higher Ed, prevents faculty and non-faculty staff members of university governing boards from taking part in board discussions relating to collective bargaining, clarifies legislative intent on how constitutional references to the State Board of Higher Ed are interpreted, enables universities with independent governing boards to continue to participate in PERS as they currently do by making those agencies for purposes of PERS, prohibits any faculty or non-faculty staff member of institutional governing board of a university from participating in collective bargaining discussions that affect faculty or non-faculty staff of that university, establishes that notices must be given to governor and the State Board of Higher Ed of intent to become a university with an independent governing board no later than June 1st, 2014, clarifies that independent governing boards of technical and regional universities shall take over administrative responsibilities for the universities on July 1st, 2015, declares an emergency and is effective on passage. Before you today, in terms of amendments, you have the dash 17s, which we heard about from Representative Nathanson last week, that relate to regional education delivery. We have the dash 19s, which change the date for the TRUs to indicate that they're interested in a governing board from June 1st, 2014 to May 15th, 2014, because that is the date that we specified in House Bill 4018, and the dash 21s, which deal with an issue that has to do with students registering to vote who are participating in the interstate tuition understanding agreements. And I think we may have someone here to talk about that today.
We had two people sign up at the public hearing to speak to this bill that we were unable to accommodate in the short amount of time that we had on Friday. I do see Ozzie Rose here in the back. Ozzie, would you like to speak this morning about
everything's okay?
Everything's just fine.
That was just continuing the study group beyond the day group.
Excuse me, sorry.
I believe that is true.
Correct. And Mario, last name Parker, had signed up to speak. He is not in the room. Any of the students want to speak to this question, or are we okay? I think everybody's fine. Okay. Excellent, then. Thanks. So we have a work session open. I would entertain a motion.
Representative Gallegos to do it.
Don, don't let me forget. I want to come back after we adopt this.
Chair Harker, I move to adopt the A-17 amendments dated February 19th, 2014.
Rep. Gallegos moves to adopt the A-17 amendments dated February 19th, 2014. Is there any discussion? Any objections? No. The amendments are adopted. And I would entertain another motion, perhaps about the A-20, the A-19s.
Chair Harker, I move to adopt the A-19 amendments dated February 19th, 2014.
Gallegos moves to adopt the dash A-19 amendments dated February 19th, 2014. Is there any discussion on these?
Could I just ask?
Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Just a clarifying question, Mr. Chair. The A. and Gross bill that came to us, I believe, contained the Dash 7 amendments, and now we're up to many, many dashes beyond that. I'm just wondering, is there anything between Dash 7 and Dash 17
Let me
and so forth?
Before I
and if, in fact, there was a process for determining which amendments we're considering and which amendments we're not considering?
Those follow that.
Because they're all A1.
Yeah, the seven amendments that it came to were Senate amendments.
Before this, right? Okay. Thought
no,
so.
No, wait.
We...
Yeah.
Of course, please
okay.
do.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Dash 7 amendments that this bill came to us with from the Senate were the Dash 7. We have had, at least have been drafted, A1 through 23 amendments.
Correct.
However, most of those have never come to the committee. We have seen a 8, 16, and then 16 through 23. Okay? So 1 through 7 never came. 9 through 15 never came to the committee. The others we have talked about.
Okay?
Good question. And when I saw the numbers, 19, 20, 21, I was even more apprehensive than...
Inquiry minds wonder.
Needed. Okay? All right.
Chair, would you clarify? So you know they were drafted, but they were not submitted to the committee for hearing, for consideration.
That's correct,
right? Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. More discussion on the A... We're on the A-19s.
Yes.
Any objections to the A-19s? Then the motion passes and the amendment, the A-19s, are adopted.
Chair Harker, I move to adopt the Dash A-21 amendments dated February 20th, 2014.
Rep. Gallegos moves to adopt the Dash A-21 amendments dated February 20th, 2014. Is there any discussion? Yes, Rep.
Mr. Chair, is this one we're going to hear some testimony and explain what we're doing on the Dash 21, or did I miss it, or can somebody else fill me in on?
Are there any students that would like to speak to this?
Is this connected with the
flip through
getting to students and into the classroom and the voter registration and all that? Because that's a different okay.
Sure, that would be great. Go for it.
Okay. My understanding, Mr. Chair, Rep. Huffman, my understanding was that this was part of a larger bill, and all that came out of it was this one piece that states that the act of registering to vote by a student who is attending a post-secondary institution of education has no effect in determining that student's eligibility to participate in the Western Undergraduate Exchange coordinated by the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education established under ORS 351.780. So the only impact is that it states in law that can't be, registering to vote can't be held against a student who is, you know, part of that exchange.
I have no idea what you just said. This is.
Are you familiar with the exchange?
No, ma'am.
Okay.
My assumption is that it would be some sort of residency. And so the fear is that if you would register to vote in Oregon, but you were living in another state, that you might lose your eligibility to do the to get the rate, the tuition rates.
Mm-hmm.
That's my understanding of this.
Yeah, if there's anyone from a student organization. Mario has not made it here. We couldn't accommodate him on Friday. We haven't had any testimony on this yet. It would be great if you could provide some.
How's it going, everybody? My name is Dylan Bloom. I work for the Associated Students of Southern Oregon University. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, essentially what this means is that currently the way it works is that several students students in various states are allowed to get reduced tuition. And I believe the states are California, Washington, Hawaii, Alaska. And what this does is it says that if you register to vote in the state of Oregon, you don't lose your WUI status for the other states. So it's just a tuition issue. It's not a voter registration issue.
Well, it is a voter registration, Mr. Chair.
Pardon?
It is a voter registration issue. Has the Secretary of State looked at this?
Has the Secretary of State looked at this? This doesn't do, I have no idea if the Secretary of State has looked at this, but this is, it doesn't change anything about how one can or does register to vote.
I think Hans can shed some light on it.
You think
Hans can shed some light?
Okay, great.
I understand the deal. We let certain people from certain states come in now and take and get in-state tuition. I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not changing their residency to pay taxes.
Okay, let's see what we can learn here. Good question.
Good morning, Representative Harker. Representative Widnett, for the record, Hans Bernard with the University of Oregon. What I know about this particular amendment is that it was considered in Senate bill and Senate rules. I can tell you the University of Oregon had significant concerns with that broader bill. The Students Association asked the universities, and specifically me at the University of Oregon, to look at this single provision. I worked with our enrollment management folks to review it. I had a conversation with Gina Zedulik in the Secretary of State's office. From their perspective, the language that you have in front of you in this amendment was narrowed and constrained based on conversations with enrollment management and feedback from the Secretary of State's office. And at this point, I can say from the University of Oregon's perspective, we're comfortable that this is written in a way that complies with the law and is workable for our enrollment management folks.
Chair, okay, I don't feel comfortable addressing this about the Secretary of State looking at this. As a military person, I lived in many states, but I was registered to vote in my home state, and that's where I pay taxes. Well, we're gonna. How can you not? All this has got to stay together. I'm understanding. I don't want your tuition to go, but it's because you're voting in that state. I mean, it's taxes, voting. When I've been in the military, when I lived in California, I paid taxes in North Carolina. That's where I voted.
While
we have vote by mail.
Okay. Rep.
Huffman? Hans did say that Gina did look at it from the Secretary of State's office and gave it a thumbs up on the narrow
Department
focus.
Department of Revenue Service look at it, or did Department of Revenue look at it?
Oh, okay. I don't know. You had said Secretary of State's
office. Yeah, I did. That's the thing.
Do you know anything, Hans, about Department of Revenue having been?
The only folks that I contacted on this bill were the Secretary of State's office and our enrollment management folks. Representative Parker.
Good. Can I ask a question?
Of course, Rep. Greenlee.
Does registering to vote automatically change the state of residence for the... it doesn't automatically make an in-state tuition, right?
Correct.
So from the school's perspective, if you're a California resident and you register to vote, it doesn't make you an Oregon resident.
That is, Rep. Parker, Representative Greenlee, that is correct.
And this bill, it seems to me, is to say, if I register and vote in Oregon, that didn't make me an Oregon resident by that simple act. So I'm still, say, a California resident would be eligible for whatever California would offer under WSHE. Is that the...
Mm-hmm. Yes, Representative Harker and Chair, or Representative Greenlee, Chair Harker. Essentially, what this does, because it's you have to, when you change your address, when you update your address and you move somewhere, you have to update your voter registration information. And so this basically, we can go to students that are WUI students and register them and update their voter registration information without their fear of losing their lower reduced tuition through WUI.
Mr. Chair.
Do you have a
yes,
state
please.
Of residence?
Rep. Upman.
Body language tells me that maybe Cindy Robert might have some... No. Information to add.
her shaking of her head.
There was a disagreement.
Doesn't
it seem like there was a disagreement with what we were hearing?
Can we get LC to discuss this drafting?
I would encourage anybody that has further clarification, because I don't think it's clear yet.
The residency is determined by voting. If you in the military, we're told, how do you determine you're living in California? How do I determine my residence? It's where you registered to vote is one primary reason to be.
Yeah, it's one, but the issue is from a university perspective. I can't be a resident of Montana, come to the University of Oregon, and get in-state tuition by registering to vote.
No, but you can vote in Oregon.
I can vote in Oregon.
Why would you want to have that privilege if you're a resident of Montana?
You have vote by mail. Why would you vote in the state you're paying taxes in?
Yeah.
Hang on, folks. Let's see what else happens.
Who knows what?
Chair Harker, members of the committee.
Well, one sec, please.
Yeah.
Finished?
Yeah, no, but...
But for now, good pausing point,
yeah,
yes?
Yeah, it's a good stopping point.
Okay.
Chair Harker and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anna Teske, academic policy analyst and government relations associate for the Oregon University System. Currently, under our residency policy that we have for our institutions, this portion is covered. So registering to vote in a state should not affect your residency requirements. I'm happy to provide the committee with that information. I can get that to you quickly if that would be helpful for this conversation.
Pardon?
Let me
yeah, go ahead. John,
sorry,
Mr. You're
Chair.
Saying from a university perspective, it doesn't affect your residency. It isn't about in-state tuition versus out-state tuition.
Right.
It might affect your resident from other purposes. I mean, if you register to vote and have a driver's license in the state, mm-hmm. for other purposes, you might be considered not a resident of the state.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my understanding of the WUI program is that it does not provide out-of-state residents with in-state tuition,
right.
nor does it affect their ability to vote in their home state. And I'm happy to give you more information. This is my limited understanding of the situation, but I do know that it has been a concern for campuses in our state to ensure that their benefit, so to speak, is secured.
Okay, very good. So Legislative Council is sending someone here to speak to this, and
thank you.
We'll see what we hear from them. Thank you both very much. And
I just don't understand, Monsieur. They want to be get this program in in-state residents, but they also want to vote. So, I mean, become an Oregon or you're Washingtonian or an Alaskan or where are you? And the main thing is taxes, where you register to pay taxes.
No, the main thing here is the question of in-state tuition.
But that's fine, but don't vote.
Don't register.
The point is that registering doesn't change your in-state or out-state status for tuition. And I think the point is you can vote in both places. The answer is except in federal elections. You might be able to vote in both places, but not for president or for...
All right. Let's see. Did Legislative Council say they thought they'd be here quickly?
Yeah, you want to stand at ease, please.
Let's stand at ease for... Until Legislative Council arrives? Yeah, for a minute. meeting and this. We have a motion on the floor to adopt the Dash A21 amendments. We've had some discussion, and a couple of key people have just arrived. So could you please come up and talk to us, Mario and Dan? Mario, why don't you go first, if you would, because you had signed up, and I think you had a presentation for us that was going to hopefully fill us in. But I see that Rep. Wisnett is not here. I thought he had come back in. Okay. Here he is. Good. Take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mario Parker-Milligan. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association. I'm speaking on behalf of the association for the Dash 21 amendment. It clarifies that registering to vote has no impact on a student's eligibility for the Western Undergraduate Exchange Program. It has no impact on current statute that, excuse me, I ran in here.
Glad to have you here.
Caught in traffic. It clarifies that registering to vote has no impact on the student's eligibility for the Western Undergraduate Exchange Program, has no change on current residency requirements for the state. It only clarifies. We asked for this amendment because thousands of students, specifically at our regional campuses, have been told by administrators that if you register to vote, that thank you. if you register to vote, you'll you may lose your WUI, which allows you to receive lower than out of state tuition. So I think a thing that's based out of fear, a lot of folks have come to us saying, why is this something? We have worked with OUS. We've talked with the Secretary of State's office and WICHE, the organization that administers the program. And they all say that this is actually needed to clarify current statute.
Mr. Chair?
Hang on one sec, please. Thank you for telling us this. The issues that have come up in the past 15 minutes or so are related to residency for the relationship between primarily voting and paying of taxes. And we have heard a little bit about the, from Hans, sorry, I'm blanking on Hans's last name, from the University of Oregon. Thank you. That the university is fine with it. Students seem to be fine with it. We heard that the Secretary of State's office had been involved in the conversation, and that they were fine with it. I hope I'm not putting words in anyone's mouth, and I'm summarizing accurately. The Department of Revenue has been raised as someone that may have, that we would like to hear weigh in on this. And if either of you know anything about the impact that this might have on taxes, That would be helpful. Okay.
Can we also hear what the WICHE program is that these students may not be eligible for, which is the primary focus of the.
And when he attempts to answer that, if I could, I think I'm going to describe this. I think part of my hang-up, so I won't put words in others' mouth, is why would a student. And I guess I didn't realize they would. Why would a California student that's at U of O register to vote in Oregon when California is their home and state of residency if they're not going to move everything to Oregon? I didn't know they did that. Or why would they? Wouldn't they do an absentee ballot and vote on Oregon or California issues and ballot?
Yeah, a lot of students do choose to do that, but a lot of folks who do live in live here in the state during the school year, during election time, like to vote where they go to school. They're paying lots in tuition, and they want to have a democratic say
Mr. Chair.
In what's going on in their community.
Okay, Rep. Wisnett, please.
Mr. Chair, I served for 27 years in the military. Okay?
Understood.
And I always had to vote absentee. You pick a state, and that's your state. Why are you wanting to vote in Oregon? Could you please answer that question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, that's a great question. A lot of folks who may not live here permanently want to be able to have a say in their local.
I don't have
governance.
That right as a military person. I lived in Virginia. I paid North Carolina taxes. I didn't get to vote on local issues.
You can vote in Budapest if you want, but the truth is that the students' right to vote in the colleges they're attending has been well established. That's not a question in this amendment.
That they want to change their residency.
They don't have to change their residency. And the university won't let you.
Can I vote in Portland?
But, Gene, then let's pass a statute here if you want that says anybody who votes here gets in-state tuition. They don't get in-state tuition. They still, if they're still a resident of Montana, they get out-of-state tuition. But the question is, this is about a special program. What is the program that they're being told they're not eligible
for? They don't get in-state. They get under the whatever the arrangement is under.
Mr. Chair, we're mixing college tuition with right to vote and residency.
I believe that when I first voted in 1972 in Ann Arbor, Michigan, I was a Michigan resident.
Yeah.
I voted there.
Yes, sir.
I had classmates from New York who registered to vote in Michigan. I believe that this has been established for quite a while, and we're not changing that in any way.
All the votes.
Let me ask the question. What's the program that's causing this problem? It's not whether they get in-state tuition. It's clear they don't get in-state tuition. But what are they being told they don't get?
WUE, the Western Undergraduate Exchange Program, allows folks from neighboring states to receive not in-state and not out-of-state, but a reduced rate from out-of-state. It's an agreement between the campus, the institution of the state of Oregon, and WICHE, the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education.
Okay. Let's hear from Legislative Council and see if Mr. Gilbert can shine any light on this. And if not, we'll take a vote and see where we wind up. Please.
Chair Harker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gilbert. I'm an attorney at Legislative Council. Unless there are specific questions, I'm not sure what I can add to what Mario has said. I unfortunately do not know the tax implications in response to your question.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
It's also residency. You can only be a resident of one state for voting purposes and for tax purposes. When you fill your taxes out, are you saying you're a full-time resident, a part-time resident of one state?
Actually, I think if you're a part-time resident, you can be part-time resident in more than one state.
Yes,
and you can thus pay taxes.
Yes, sir.
Earning income in more than one state, one can owe taxes in more than one state. So I don't think that if we accept that we can only register to vote in one state, then I don't think that it's a one-to-one link between voting and paying of taxes. Yes, sir.
Do they help?
I forgot the LC.
You worked with the Secretary of State on this issue. So if this thing passes, and I guess it will because there's more people supporting than probably defending it, is that state going to be notified that this person's registered to vote in Oregon now and he can't vote in California, Washington, Alaska, or wherever? How does that do? Did the Secretary of State talk to you about that?
Chair Harker, Representative Wisnett, I have not personally had...
Mr. Chair,
yes,
the question isn't whether students can vote and still maintain their residence. That's established. That's an existing statute. This isn't about this amendment. This amendment doesn't change it one way or the other.
You can't vote anywhere you want.
What?
And still get the discount. You can't be a resident of two states.
Well, you can be a resident of two states. You're a resident of five states. The question is, which is your primary state for a variety of things, including taxes?
I'm the primary resident, yes, sir.
And students, it has been established in statute and through the courts that students can vote in the campus they're living in without changing their state of residence.
I disagree.
Oh, you disagree with that one?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay.
That's not a matter of opinion. The military can't.
You're entitled to your own opinion. You're not entitled to your own facts.
I am, based on my experience in the military. You can't.
Okay. Further discussion. Mario.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Current OAR, I don't have the number in front of me. I can pull it up in a moment. Oregon University policy says that the act of registering to vote does not provide sufficient evidence in determining residency. So,
Constitution.
Yeah, it's OAR 580-010-0030. It's not one of the criteria for determining residency for tuition purposes.
Rep. Huffman. Mr. Chair, I'm going to be a no because not because of what they're trying to do. I just disagree with the language that enlightened me this morning to what I believe we're practicing in Oregon, and I think it's a serious underlying problem. Because I agree with Representative Wisnett, my interpretation was primary residency was attached to your voting rights and privileges. And now I'm finding out that maybe there are some exceptions to that. There's no way that we can be checking if a student... there is a way, but I guarantee you it's not being checked that a student is voting in Oregon and California both. I do not agree with that at all.
Okay, certainly.
One person, one vote.
Right, agreed. Legitimate concern. I wish I could vote on some things in Sisters, and I can't get to you.
Sisters are registration day.
Let's stand at ease for just a minute, okay? So we're going to resume the meeting here. We do not yet have a fiscal on this amendment, it turns out, so what we're going to do is open up the next portion of the agenda and begin that conversation, and we'll see if the fiscal shows up before we're finished here this morning. Okay?
Thank you.
You both very much, and thanks to everyone here for their input and patience and thought. So I'm not going to close that, right? And I am going to open an informational hearing, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Open an informational hearing on the HEC strategic plan. And welcome to the dais, Ben Cannon. And Tim Nesbitt, please. And there they are. Okay, good. I was listening to you, so I couldn't do it. Take it away, gentlemen.
Welcome. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt. I am chair of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and with me is Ben Cannon, our executive director. We are your and the governor's coordinating body for the achievement of our 40-40 post-secondary education goals. A lot of work precedes ours, and we're building on that work. But most importantly now, we take it as our responsibility to move beyond planning to doing, and in coordination with our post-secondary institutions, beginning in this biennium, to move forward to achieve those goals between now and the year 2025. The legislation which created our commission also charges us with creating a strategic plan for the achievement of our 40-40 post-secondary goals, and we have begun that process today, and I and Ben will walk you through what we have in mind. And let me right now turn this over to Ben Cannon.
Thank you. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Glad to be back at this committee. Following Tim and my presentation with slides, we have a couple of panels at the chair's indulgence and time willing, including Ed Ray, Connie Green, and Larry Large, Hans Bernard, and Debbie Koreski, on behalf of their respective institutions, to chime in. Each of these folks and their institutions have been involved in the development and feedback on the plan as it has emerged, and so we look forward to their remarks as well as your questions and comments. We'll try to be brief, relatively brief with the slides. There's a lot of data and a lot of information here. Stop us if you have questions, but want to be sure to leave time for both your continuing work on the bill as well as the folks behind us. So this doesn't take long because, of course, it's very familiar to you. It is the 40-40-20 goal. I'm going to come back to it in a few slides with some proposals for refinement. This is essentially as it exists in statute, that 40% of adult Oregonians will hold the bachelor's or advanced degree by 2025, 40% will hold an associate's degree or meaningful post-secondary certificate, and all adult Oregonians will hold a high school diploma. I'll come back. Why is that important? Well, a big part of the rationale, as you well know, having worked on the issue, is the economic imperative, both for individuals as well as collectively, of higher levels of education attainment. The bars on the right-hand side indicating median annual earnings for people with at different degree levels, and the left-hand side, unemployment rates. And no surprise there to this committee relative to the relationship between education and earnings. Where do we stand? Well, when we survey Oregon adults, and this is all Oregonians 25 and over, about 29.9% report having received a bachelor's degree or higher. That places Oregon in the upper half of the country. To be clear, several percentage here are the result of the positive effects of in-migration. We import more people with higher levels of degrees than we export, so we benefit to some extent from that phenomenon. But Oregon is in the upper half, but still well short of the upper 40. If we look at the year 2012, last year or 2 years ago, what would be required to reach our distance from 40-40-20, I mentioned the upper 40. But clearly we would have had to do quite a bit better with our high school graduates, so 11,000 more of them graduating than did. 480,000, the gap between adults, for adults short of the associate's degree or certificate, and a gap of about 189,000 adults for a bachelor's degree. To be clear, those latter two, that 480,000 and 189,000, those are relative to the entire adult population. And to go back to that 40-40-20 goal on the second slide here, that goal is expressed for all adults, which, of course, presents, I think, real practical challenges as well as some definitional challenges. So we've proposed, and the OEIB has received these recommendations and will be at a joint meeting with the HEC, potentially advancing a policy statement that attempts to sort of refine 40-40-20 and its application to adults versus the pipeline. Again, the pipeline is that class of 2025. That would be today's first graders. The adult population is sort of all Oregonians of adult age. The statute speaks specifically to the adult population, but in the very first report that was ever done about 40-40-20 after the legislation passed, it sort of acknowledged in the report that the legislature probably did not intend for 40-40-20, or at least that 100% of earning a high school diploma to apply to all adults. The intent was not that in the year 2025 we would be trying to re-educate or every 70-year-old, 80-year-old who hadn't yet received a high school certificate or a high school diploma in order to meet that 100%. So this refinement suggests that for the pipeline, 40-40-20 does apply, I mean, we do. Our expectations are that the class of 2025, that today's first graders, are achieving at those rates, and it does also have implications for the adult population. And there are goals embedded within 40-40-20 for adults, but they may be likelier. We may be better served to refine that 40-40-20 for the adult population relative, in particular, to what certificates and degrees are associated with jobs that are available in the nearer term. It's in some ways a less of an aspirational and more what does our labor market and job market require for adults. I'll turn it over to Tim. Oh, sorry, one more slide here. In terms of the middle 40, this is the other place where we've had, I think, significant sort of definitional questions. The legislature, I think, probably appropriately left it open. We're proposing a broad conception of what credentials count towards the middle 40, strongly informed by employer demands. And examples here, and we have a larger set, there are hundreds that would count under this broader conception, but they include, of course, the 2 years associate's degrees, but also career pathway certificates, industry recognized certificates, and registered apprenticeships. So that's also sort of a policy statement that we're proposing to make, and then to build our funding and coordination strategies around.
Excuse us, please.
Rep. Greenlick has a question or a comment.
The executive director, or perhaps the chair, want to answer this question. If your strategic plan is a serious strategic plan, are you really taking 40-40-20 as a real goal that you intend to get the resources to move to, modify it as you express it? And I think that makes a lot of sense to modify it. Or is this just some words to talk about when you want to ask for more money? I mean, the quality education model is exactly... Nobody ever took this seriously when we got $1 billion away, when we got $2 billion, I think now maybe we're $3 billion, I don't know how far away from that. And it seems to me that that reality is a little hard to bring to bear on this 40-40-20. And the question is, how seriously are you really taking it?
Representative Greenlick, Chair Harker, it's a good and important question. First of all, I would... I worked for a governor who described 40-40-20 as a North Star, a trajectory, not a destination. It is an aspirational goal that is embedded within the very idea of 100% of anything, right, is the notion of it being aspirational. Secondly, I would say that one of, for me, and I think for many, one of the very most important things about 40-40-20 is the statement of belief that it it contains about the potential of all Oregonians to succeed, and then the obligation of the systems and the policies to provide for opportunity for their success. But I think, you know, most directly, the answer to your question is yes. We intend to build policies, build funding models, build guidance to the legislature and governor around the idea that 40-40-20 ought to be realized or come very close to being realized with these modifications by the year 2025. Ultimately, it will be, of course, up to many other decision makers, including the legislature, about the extent to which we are able to achieve that trajectory, not just the legislature, communities, community leaders, students themselves, but we are taking it seriously.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair.
Of course.
I know this question. Yeah. If you said our aspiration goal is to get to 40-40-20, fine, that's the North Star. We keep following the North Star as we're in our journey. You say we're going to get there by 2025. I don't expect to be sitting on the North Star by 2025. I expect to continue to guide us in a direction. Every bill that's come to us has been in aid of 40-40-20, which means nobody really believes it's going to happen, and that it's not even an educational problem, it's a social problem. I mean, do you really believe every single adult in 1925, I mean in 2025, is going to have a high school diploma? Only if we give them out as as a present with candy or something.
Representative Greenlee, Chair Harker, to that point, one of the refinements that we're proposing, as I think you noticed, was that the goals for the entire adult population would be refined. That it's not, it was not even the intent, I believe, of 40-40-20 to say that in the year 2025, all Oregon adults would have a high school diploma. I don't think that was what this legislature intended to say about the goal. And so we are proposing a refinement that would distinguish between that pipeline goal and the adult population.
But you believe that that cohort literally could earn a high school degree? 100% of those kids, whatever their life status, whatever their mental status, whatever their emotional status, they can, in fact, earn a high school degree.
Representative Greenlee, Chair Harker, I believe that it would be an abrogation of the responsibility of our commission to suggest that anything else than 100% completion for our today's first graders is appropriate. And it certainly would be for us to suggest otherwise would be to dismiss the work that this legislature, your legislature, has done to establish this goal for us. I think if you choose in 2015 to have a discussion about changing 40-40-20, we obviously would, you know, participate in that and follow your lead. But at this point, this remains our trajectory. And it's to me, it's less about, there's a measuring stick aspect of 40-40-20 that's quite important. But I think we should be careful not to use 40-40-20 in this way, in a way that lends itself to very highly arbitrary sorts of punitive approaches based on whether or not we're meeting some quite ultimately pretty arbitrary trajectory. It is, I think what it can do and what it has effectively done over the last several years since passage is bring together a lot of organization stakeholders around a conception of what Oregon's educational future ought to be. And it's one that is clearly highly aspirational.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry to get to this point.
Just checking to see if the Emperor has clothes. See? Yes, Rep. Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to get on the record. I've been trying to figure out where the conversations have been going on the last year or two surrounding Common Core and the direction we're headed there and where the conversations have taken place and are taking place between K-12 and higher ed. I've had a challenge finding anybody that can address my questions about State Board adopted Common Core under different leadership. We're still headed down that path. I've asked some folks in higher ed how much conversation went on between the board and higher ed to determine how the Common Core, in fact, will advance the 40-40-20 goals for our graduation rate. How are the Common Core going to get more students through in 4, or I'll give even 5 years, but you know, how many more diplomas are going to be in the hands of students because of Common Core? How is it going to prepare graduating students for college? How are we going to dramatically reduce the need for remediation that we always hear in this committee, that so many students come into higher ed and they have to have even up to a year of remediation before they can even get into college? Those are the kinds of things that I'm concerned about, and I've honestly struggled to find anybody that can give an answer. We seem to be hell-bent going down that Common Core road, but have we seriously looked at the merging of that high school graduate getting into helping us meet the goals, that middle 40?
Representative.
Thank you. Excellent question and comments. And while I am very...
I think it was more of a comment.
Okay. While I'm very interested in those thoughts, I'm double booked this morning. I have to go to the Rules Committee now. So carry on without me.
Yeah,
thank you.
It was more of a comment to think about, to get on the record.
Representative Huffman, Mr. Chair, I think it's something I'd love to follow up with you and bring the appropriate people, not back, including myself necessarily, but back, the appropriate folks to talk with you about it. There is a lot of work going on in that arena.
Actually, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Rep. Gorsuch.
Thank you. Could we have that conversation for all of us? I'd be very interested in it as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd be happy to participate then.
Thank you, Mr. Keenan.
And if I could, on that point, our commission will be having the joint meeting, our first joint meeting with the Oregon Education Investment Board next month, and this will be a topic of conversation between our commission and the board. If I may, I'd like to go quickly through the next series of slides, and what they're going to do is reinforce Representative Greenlick's skepticism about the daunting nature of this 40-40-20 challenge that we face. But we're not trying to present it with any kind of rose coloration here. We're trying to look seriously at everything that makes this such a daunting challenge. And, of course, fundamentally, we are far behind. I'm talking now about the 40-40 post-secondary goals. We're far behind attaining those at current rates of education. In addition, when we look at the students in the pipeline, and by the way, there are 45 to 50,000 students in our public K-12 system, and that means if we're graduating 45 to 50,000 each year hereafter, we should be, to get to 40 and 40, awarding between 18 and 20,000 two-year degrees and certificates, and 18 to 20,000 four-year degrees for Oregonians. So that's how we quantify that challenge. But we do have a situation where too few of our students are going on to pursue post-secondary education, and too many of them are not completing. There's a demographic challenge of the fact that as you go back through those grade levels, each of those 45 to 50,000 groups of students, we see many more students from families of poverty and many more students for whom college has not been part of their family's experience, and many more students who have been underrepresented and underserved in our post-secondary education system. There's also the challenge of our relatively slow-growing personal income and stagnant middle income, middle class incomes, which lead to a constraint on the ability to pay for students and their families. We have other side of the same coin, the fiscal challenge, where the state is now looking at revenue growth approximating 5% a year. We just, before the Great Recession, we were seeing 6.5% a year. So that's a significant shift in the trajectory of future revenue growth, and you know only too well, better than I, the competition for general funds, especially for health care and corrections. So all those factor into our ability to achieve these goals and make the investments needed to achieve them. And then every year that goes by, we see an increase in the number of students, or now young adults, who've left school, who don't have college degrees, and so our number gets larger. Until we can catch up with the pipeline, students in the pipeline, and make sure we're reaching our 40-40 goals with them, we're also going to be falling farther and farther behind with the adult population, which is what has led to the different focus that you heard from Ben Cannon on how to address that adult population. A number of charts here will show you the... I can't even read it from here, Ben. Maybe you can read that one too.
Sure. This chart reflects attainment levels for sort of linked to 40-40-20 for different subpopulations. So you see the significant challenges that we have, particularly with the Hispanic, Latino, the American Indian, Alaska Native, a system that historically has not served those students well, and we have a great long ways to go there.
Might help if we all became Asian.
And here's a new measure that we hadn't seen before, but about 28% of our K-12 students have at one time or another qualified for free or reduced price lunch. That's one indication of poverty. And those bars on that graph show you their representation in our universities. We were able to track from data provided by the Department of Education students who were in those categories and where they tended to show up in our university system. And you see that Eastern and Western in particular have high percentages of students from backgrounds in poverty. Yeah.
Mr. Nesbitt, back to your last slide. To reach or to work towards our goal of 40-40-20, I think we need to do a better job in K-12 with English as a second language. Would you agree with that?
And we definitely view English language learners as
other
one
states
category.
Are having more success than we are.
Yes.
I attended a school recently and observed what's happening, and I think we can do a better job with English as a second language, money-wise, and attention to that requirement. Would you agree, and is the HEC going to be continuing to look at this?
We do, and we'll be working on that in conjunction with the OAIB representative. Thank you. We're able now, with data provided by the Department of Education, to track the what was the sophomore class of 2003, the graduating high school class of 2005, and not surprisingly, you see their rates of participation in post-secondary education decline over time. I think even more telling is going to be the completion rates. I'll mention that in a moment.
What's the bottom of that?
The bottom years since high school graduation.
Right, so you're looking out in years since high school graduation. This is looking back at the class of 2005, and you can see since their graduation, as time goes by, their post-secondary enrollment shrinks. They've either completed and left, or they've dropped out, and you'll see some refinement of that in the next slide.
And from the same data, for the same cohort of students, you now see that by this year, we have 65% who have not managed to achieve a degree, and only 35% who have. That compares to the total of 80% of that constitutes the 40-40 post-secondary goal.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Tim, does this include... I mean, post-secondary, but I'm assuming it's more of the college and university system. Does it include the apprenticeship programs, which we consider in the middle 40, like IBEW and an electrician training?
Mr. Vice Chair, it does not, but it should, and that's going to be a refinement we're going to be adding to this as we go forward. We also, as Ben Cannon told you, are working to identify all of the certificates that we should be counting as high-value certificates, and we'll be doing that in conjunction with the Workforce Investment Board.
I would hope that at the end there we would get an uptick, especially if we took it out to 12 years maybe instead of, because Joe Esmond has testified that their student is significantly older.
Mm-hmm. This next chart you may have seen before. It was prepared by OUS, and it shows the investment. That blue bar represents both the state's direct investment in the education of our students, as well as the and the yellow bar would represent the returns, both the tangible returns in terms of income tax and other revenues from wage earners, as well as the either positive or negative experience with the state thereafter. Do they need services? Are they likely to offend and therefore be incarcerated, et cetera? And it's only after we get into the post-secondary system, post-K-12, that the return on investment turns positive for the state, when you factor in all of those elements. Here we see a mapping of the degrees held by Oregonians, and we find that there is a higher than expected concentration in some fields. I think you've seen this chart from an earlier presentation. Mm-hmm. And lower than expected in some of the high demand occupations like engineering and computer and business. So that suggests there has been something of a mismatch between the degrees produced or the people who moved to Oregon with certain kinds of degrees and the demands in the job market. We also have the distinction...
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. To go back to that slide, can you tell me what is that top bar? It says environment. What does that mean exactly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gorsuch, I believe this bar, and I'm sorry that the words got cut off here, I think it includes people...
Natural resources.
So it's, and it may not be surprising. I think the way this is a fairly crude estimation of the location quotient. Oregon, as a natural resource state, at least in some respects, it, not surprisingly, would have some level of overrepresentation.
So I should
national
average. Thank you. I should correct what I just said, because this shows our degree holders compared to the national profile of degree holders, and it's not a comparison to our state's workforce. And then we also see that we have a lower percentage of our college degree holding citizens who work full time. And that's another factor which perhaps reflects our choice of occupations as well as choice of lifestyle. These next two charts show you the state investment over the last several decades versus that yellow line is enrollment. And I've been sharing, and I think the next one does the same for community colleges. Mm-hmm. I've been sharing the observation with our presidents at the colleges and universities that the last several decades are really a story of achievement in spite of disinvestment. When you see the growing number of enrolled students, the growing number of degrees awarded, and yet the relative flatlining of state investment.
So that's,
and if I can just summarize, the findings from all this data really gave us a sense of priority that we have to find ways to make sure students complete. There's probably no worse outcome than a student going on to community college or university, in many cases borrowing money but paying high tuition and not completing, and then being saddled with debt. And also, the time to completion is going to matter a lot. When you think of the fact that if you're not able to invest more money in our post-secondary system and therefore more cost shifts to the student, in a sense that lowers the return on investment for the student and his or her family. It maybe helps the state's return on investment, but it doesn't help the students. And vice versa, if we freeze tuition going forward and we put more money into the system for the same outcomes, it will, in a sense, lower the state's return on investment. The only thing that will help both students and the state will be to see students get through more efficiently, at shortening the time to degree and making sure they complete. That's the win-win. And when you, if you look at the current rates of completion that we aspire to, let's say we could even pencil out something like a 70 or 80% completion rate in our four-year system and a 50% completion rate in our two-year system. Ironically, we'd have to be sending 137% of our high school graduates to our community colleges and universities in order to produce the degrees we need. So we really do have to focus on the throughput and completion, and that you're going to see those themes come forward in what we present next.
So taking this background information, we've tried to describe, or what's different about the HEC? We've known about these challenges. You've known about these challenges for years. So what are we doing differently within the governance system for higher education? And attempting to compare an old paradigm with a new paradigm here. So whereas the old paradigm could have been described as one that is organized around sustaining institutions, the new paradigm, at least as it's represented by the HEC, is designed to is really organized around maximizing student success. And you'll see this as we get into the sort of action steps that we're proposing. The old paradigm where state budgeting constraints encouraged opaque cost shifting to institutions and to students, at a minimum, the HEC can and will clarify the consequences of budget constraints for decision makers such as yourselves. Under the old paradigm where the state provided resources to institutions based primarily, if not solely, on student enrollment, the new paradigm is one where with some guidance and direction from us, the state will be providing resources to students to maximize learning outcomes and student success. And then, of course, you know, you went through last session the shift from a system that was really centrally state-governed and managed for the 4 years to one where, much as it has been for the community colleges, coordination is centralized to the state, but governance and management is really the responsibility of a local board. You've seen these slides before. We're focused on the right-hand side. I won't go over it except to note that I always like to say this shows a top-down, but really these should be understood side-by-side, the state with the HEC and its agencies on one side of the page and our institutions with their locally, in some cases elected or in other cases state-appointed, but local boards governing on the other side of the page. We're going to talk about the four categories. These are also reflected in the four-page handout, but we've organized our work in terms of four categories. So number one, broaden and improve the pathways to our 40-40-20 goal. Number two, make those pathways accessible, affordable, and supportive for students. Number three, to steer the higher education enterprise. And fourth, to cheer the promotion of college completion and career readiness. And we'll go back and forth through these last slides to describe those in a little more detail.
And in each of these categories, I want to call out what authorities we have that you've given us in the legislation and how we intend to use those authorities to accomplish these goals. So when it comes to broadening the pathway, this speaks to our responsibility for constructing a recommended budget for institutional capacity and student support, to develop the post-secondary elements of the longitudinal student database, and to refine our 40-40 goals and develop the metrics to keep us on track to achieve them. So for the coming year, actually the coming year and a half, the remainder of this biennium, we've identified the following action items to clarify the 40-40-20 goals in the way that Ben Cannon just shared with you, where we have a different set of strategies for students in the pipeline and another set of strategies for older adults, working age adults, and for their needs. We will be working with the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and we've already met with them on identifying for the middle 40, what are the high-demand occupations, what are those certificates and programs that are geared to get students into those jobs and those occupations. We will be developing, and this is an important part of how we intend to approach both the budgeting and the funding formula work we'll be doing, a profile of all the students to be served, all the way back to those first graders. And we have a different demographic profile for each cohort. And that's going to influence the extent to which we think certain students will require certain kinds of support beyond just opening the door wide to invite them to participate in our post-secondary system. We'll be developing the metrics for monitoring progress in this regard, and we will be providing and have just provided budget guidance to our post-secondary institutions as we ask for their input on preparing what will be our consolidated budget request.
Chair, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Mr. Nesbitt, I think a big action item is that I don't see there, and I'm not sure what your relationship is with the universities and the OUS system. But we've had a work group working on trying to find ways to for the universities to bring the cost down. I'm hoping the heck part of 3472 can look at things like having deans look at requirements for graduation. I've gone to conferences where, you know, to have those deans, you know, bring down the required courses, have more electives. I don't see performance measurement on there. We should be giving money to colleges based upon performance, not admissions.
That's coming on the next slide.
Thank you, sir. But okay. So are you going to you're doing that, or you got another slide you're going to talk about that?
Yes, we are, Representative.
Yeah, so three more slides with action items and tools that we'll be using. So on this the second of four, making the pathways accessible, affordable, and supportive for students. So our tools, these are really statutory authorities. One is the simple approval or denial of university tuition increases above 5%. The second, Representative Wisden, I think speaks to a portion of your question around identifying best practices, analyzing program effectiveness, and developing policy options and pilot project design. So working in conjunction with the legislature as a signed by law or with the institutions or both to develop and disseminate best practices. We have authorities relative to the private system, and we are proposing mechanisms to help guide and coach students through post-secondary education, understanding that more and more of them are experiencing it really as a network of multiple institutions, not as I did beginning as a freshman and leaving as a senior. At one. So the action items here, some of them are very familiar to you since you help create them for the, these are short-term actions that we're working on today. You'll receive our tuition freeze study very shortly. You, as you know, we're working on the pay it forward pilot, potential recommendations around redesigning financial aid, and the interstate approval for distance education. The final mechanism here is associated with that last tool, and it is the potential for expanding the state's presence in terms of a web-based portal for student navigation of the system. We'll get more on the specific sort of funding question that you asked, Representative Wisnett, in a moment.
And Representative Johnson has a question.
Thank you. I'm glad to see the editing that happened between the slide there and what we have in our handout here regarding pay it forward, because the slide we have here says you'll design the pay it forward pilot, and now you've good amended that to consider, or the word consider, which is really what the legislation, you know, had in it, as you're well aware. So that was my question. You know, I wanted to make sure that the heck first embarked upon a process to consider if there's any. There's any there before you invest a lot of time. I know you've got a work group that's been commissioned to work on that pilot, but as we talk about all of these daunting and significant policy recommendations and so forth that you're working on, there are some major issues, and I want to ensure that the talent and the manpower and woman power on the heck is used in some fruitful outcomes, and I think you'll get into some of those in the slides to come, but that would be my hope, and I'm glad to see that you've made that change.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
On top of what Representative Johnson, that bill was a compromise bill with Chair Dimbrough and Chair Harger that we put out there. It was to originally to do a pilot project, but we toned it down to consider a pilot project, so one step before that. So thank you, Representative Johnson stated.
Next, as you know, we are a coordinating commission. We're not a governing board, and therefore we have called our authorities those of steering the institutions, not trying to do their work for them. And that begins with developing the funding formulas and the models to distribute funds to our institutions. We'll talk more about that under action items. We have also to review and approve the public university missions and the post-secondary academic programs. That includes the community colleges. And we'll be looking at incorporating the rules which the Community College and Workforce Development Department and the Chancellor's Office had in place for program approval as a starting point. We'll be advising and assisting the OEIB in developing the state achievement compact goals, and we've already had communications with the presidents of the colleges and universities on ways to improve those. We will be establishing a system of credit for prior learning. We've been directed to do that, and I want to report on that in a minute, which will promote efficient articulation and transfer programs. We also see we also have the responsibility to coordinate among the OEIB, K-12 districts, education service districts, and to advance such initiatives as the STEM initiative. When I finish here today, I'm going to be meeting with the STEM Council in Corvallis, so we're going to be starting those discussions. And then setting expectations as well for our schools of education to better meet the needs of the people in the continuum. When it comes to action items, we are working right now on looking at not only how we would construct the budget to be recommended for the next biennium, but how the dollars would flow, building off of the existing RAM model, and as well looking at how the community colleges have developed their formula for the distribution of funds. It's kind of going to be hard to keep a sharp division between the budget work and the funding formula work, but I think there's a common theme emerging in both areas now, and that is we need to be paying more attention to the resources needed to support students to progress successfully and to completion. And that means as we look at the as we complete that profile we referred to previously about the students to be served, we'll be getting a better idea of those students who are first-time college going, who come from disadvantaged backgrounds, who will need those extra support services, not just in the classroom, but in wraparound services like coaching and mentoring and the other supports that have been proven around the country to be exactly what it takes to achieve student success. So when we're looking at all the ways in which the dollars may flow, we'll be looking at when it comes to support for students, what's the relative advantage or disadvantage of freezing tuition versus putting more money into need-based financial aid through the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. We'll be looking at ways at the funds needed to support the efforts of our colleges and universities in the delivery of education, but also in those support services, those wraparound services that are going to be needed to ensure student success.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe President Ray can address this too when he comes up from a institutional perspective. One of the things that I've been I will be looking for with great interest as we move forward is kind of tied in with everything that you've just been saying. You know, we've been used to having the Chancellor's Office. You know, Jay Kenton will come before Ways and Means and the Capital Construction Committee, and he can answer questions for all institutions. It's going to be interesting as a cap construction person and Ways and Means as we move forward to see how the asks come and the making sure that balancing act, and sometimes it gets pretty, you know, fine line between, you know, how much is going
how much is too much going to capital construction, and that balancing point, so that we're not having to increase tuition because we're channeling debt service over. You know, so it's going to be interesting. I'm sure you guys have given a lot of thought to that, and I don't know if you want to say, but President Ray's perspective would be interesting, too, as we make those changes.
Well, Ben and I met with the financial VPs of the university system just last week, and this question was in the forefront of our conversations. So do you want to add anything?
I would only add, Representative Huffman, that it is a responsibility of our commission to bring to you a recommendation around capital and priorities within it, the balance of capital investments versus operation funds, and we'll have, under the budget that you approved last biennium, we'll have a certain amount of staff to do that in preparation for 2015. So it is a responsibility that we take seriously, and you should look to us for that advice.
So among the action items of the work we're doing on the funding formula, we will be approving the university missions and establishing a program approval process, as I mentioned. We were directed in the legislation that established the university boards to evaluate their performance annually. So the first year would be the 14-15 fiscal year for that evaluation. But we want to make sure that we have in place by the start of that fiscal year the criteria that we'll use for that evaluation. It's only fair to do so, and we're doing so in conversations with the universities, and we'll make sure we have those in place at the start of the coming fiscal year. We've had a very productive work group reporting to us, working on credit for prior learning. And we've encouraged them, and they're going to report back to us at our next meeting on the feasibility of this, to try and launch a pilot project as early as July 1 that, for the coming school year. And that would involve at least one of our colleges and one of our universities. So I want to call out their work. I think you received their report separately. They're really making great strides, and it was at our encouragement that they're going to try and give us a pilot project starting as early as the next academic year. We have what we call convening authority. We can bring people together, provosts, deans, and others, and we want to do that to encourage, without having to mandate through rules, but to encourage the adoption of best practices, things like the use of common standards and assessments. Ideas have come forward from a prior report on textbook affordability, and so we're making headway there, and some of our universities are already and our colleges are adopting some of those recommendations. So that leaves the cheering function, which Ben will
talk about. Just really briefly, I think we believed, our commission believed, it wasn't enough to implement good policies, that we also have a role in helping to build public support and awareness, deepen a college-going culture, engage the public, philanthropic organizations, and community-based partners in the creation of that culture of not only college-going but college completion, and to support initiatives that meet the needs, in particular, first-time college students and underrepresented populations. We've begun this work already by attempting to compile an inventory of public attitudes about post-secondary, so we're getting some of that sort of baseline data about public attitudes, both locally and nationally. We will be developing and implementing an external communications plan, and Tim's been very much involved in helping to design a proposal and soon likely launch of a pilot program this year, starting this spring, to boost the number of Oregon students who are completing FAFSAs and as a result becoming eligible for Pell grants, at no cost to the Oregon budget, but under that federal program that does so much to assist low-income Oregonians to attend college. We think there's significant opportunity even in this year to improve the number of Oregonians who receive Pell grants. They're already Pell eligible. They may already be enrolled, but aren't accessing Pell.
So with that, again, our 40-40-20 goals are in our sight, but we are challenging ourselves not just to give you reports about next biennium, but to actually get moving and start accomplishing what it takes to make progress every year. This is more of an initial action plan than it is an overarching strategic plan, but we'll be bringing you plans of this kind and updating them. And what we hope to do is every biennium then to be giving you a progress report on how far we've progressed in terms of reaching the 40-40 post-secondary goals, what it will take to make more progress in the next biennium, and continue to recalibrate to keep our eyes fixed on the year 2025 and the achievement of those goals.
Thank you. Any questions? Yeah. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess to both of you, you obviously have a lot on your plate, and hopefully we don't put a lot more there anytime soon, but I guess I would just counsel you to, in pursuit of perfection, don't be so caught up in trying to do everything for every potential segment of the population, at the expense of not coming away with any tangible sometime soon. You know, some of us have sat here for the last 4 years and have seen these same slides for 4 years in a row about the types of degrees that we're producing and how they aren't really connected with our private sector needs, with our workforce development and so forth. And I'm hoping that in this biennium that there can be some real changes and incentives to try to change that paradigm to bring about the type of outcomes that we've been looking for and we've been promised now as we've set off down this 40-40 pathway. So I would just encourage you to jump in with all the vigor that you have in some of those areas where we know we can get some results in fairly short order as we work on some of the more daunting responsibilities. So thank you.
Other questions? I do have a couple of questions that have to do with recognizing the challenge that you face. But I'm just curious. I know with the Oregon Health Authority and with DHS, both of those organizations being sort of challenged to bring about organizational change within those institutions, and you're set about the same goal. My understanding, though, is they're looking a lot at lean manufacturing models, and I'm trying to look for those in your planning process. Is that part of what you're thinking about? Is if lean manufacturing, lean methodologies look at the elimination of waste as their organizing principle, is that similar to what you're thinking here?
Rep Kayagos, members of the committee, it's not a conversation that we've had directly, and I'd be interested in sort of understanding better what's going on within those agencies. And then, of course, in our sector, where the vast majority of the dollars in the organization is not at the state, it's not within our direct sort of management purview. Yeah. I'll have a staff of 12, right, directly, and then plus CCWD and OSAC, so it's somewhat larger than that, and certainly attempting to bring to bear those best practices for a sort of lean agency management, but the resources, the vast majority of them are in the institutions themselves.
Well, the reason I ask is that one of the outcomes of that particular approach to organization is that you get a flattened out hierarchy, and you get much more participation at the bottom level. And so going back to your comments about the demographic, the Latino, the Native American, I mean, quite frankly, those demographics have not changed in 50 years. You've still got about the same proportion of Latinos and Native Americans not getting through the higher education. I mean, it's just amazing. And so my question is, what it made me think about is that in the 30s, marijuana was not a problem, wasn't seen as a social problem, because it was located mainly in the Latino, African American, the jazz community, and so on, in the minority communities. It became a problem in the 60s when the white population started partaking in marijuana. And I guess what I'm getting at is now all of a sudden we see this as such a critical demographic problem, again, because we have a larger demographic of not just people of color, but white young people who are now not graduating from college and so on. So I guess I'm just thinking about how we sort of think about this problem and so on. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is, what is it we're thinking about in terms of accommodating those two demographics, the Native American and the Latino communities? Are they part of your discussions as to what kinds of changes need to happen within our higher education structure?
Yeah, so I'll call out a couple of ways in which we're taking that question on directly. And they're at this point more philosophical in principle than they are specific action steps, but they translate to action steps, I think, really, really well. One is the idea that just as K-12 has historically put extra weight behind certain types of students who are, because they're language learners or because they've historically been underserved, they are more costly to serve. That is something that ought to be under pretty significant consideration at higher education as well, which isn't to say that K-12 has necessarily spent all those dollars well enough, but it is to say that we ought to take a real serious look at that question of funding weight. The other is something that Tim alluded to, which is the idea that these population experience around the country and in Oregon would suggest, and you might hear this or ask this of the institutional representatives, that these populations require a different set of supports, right? And I'm not an expert on what those supports are, but they would tend to be in the realm of guidance, counseling, and other sort of on-campus, or maybe not on-campus, but in their world, supports to help deal with the challenges that right. they face.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's a challenge.
Isn't that the same slide that was on when I left?
We've come full circle. Thank you. We want to make sure we have time to hear from the institutional representatives.
Right. So these are our next steps. So we'll call the next panel. Connie Green, Larry Large, Ed Ray.
Are you planning on working a bill yet before we adjourn?
I don't believe we're going to be working a bill before we adjourn. I think we're not going to adjourn, or we're going to do whatever is required to come back later today after we get the fiscal on the amendment that we were last discussing. So
we don't need to be anxious about the time.
I believe that's right, but feel free anyway.
Be anxious?
Yes.
Floating anxiety is always available.
I just don't want to be the only one.
Okay. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Connie Green. I'm president of Timothy Bay Community College. And I thank you for letting us share some responses and some support. Overall, the community colleges are looking at this plan and saying it's on the right direction. The broad strokes of the plan make a lot of sense. Adding the adult population as a way to discuss some of these things helps a lot versus just talking about a pipeline, because as you know, community colleges in the 20-40-40, we have 20%. We do a lot with adults who don't have a high school degree, need a GED, need adult basic skills. We do a lot with our high schools and dual credit to get students ready for going on to college. So that 20% is important to us. As well as, though, about for most of us, our adult population is about 60-70% people who are over 24 that we serve. People who are coming back for a lot of reasons, either because they've already have a degree and want to get a skill, because they don't have a degree and want to get a skill. So we do a lot of that middle 40, and appreciate working with the heck and others to define the middle 40. When it first came out, we knew it was aspirational. We know we have a lot of adults who don't have that degree, but they have some credits. And our commitment is that we would use credentialing. Industry can have bright lights now. Industry credentialing. We would use career pathway certificates, regular for 1-year certificates, and associate degrees. We work with our apprenticeship partners, and so we already have apprenticeship, those who get degrees built into some of the certificates that we're counting. So we look forward to refining that together. You know, the adults in the pipeline, the 40-40-20, community colleges are committed to this, we're committed to the plan, but we've been doing this work. So we have a community college completion, persistence, and success plan. We've updated every 2 years. We have things in that plan that we look forward to incorporating into the HEC plan. We have talked about how student success, you have to start with connection. And I mentioned earlier about working with our high schools, and whether it's Common Core, whether it's alignment of curriculum, our commitment is to work with them and to have students coming ready for college. Redesign our developmental ed. This 4 year, we've got teams of 4 from every community college working together to redesign developmental ed. We know it's a gap. We also know that it's not just an easy answer. We're looking at best practices to get there. So in our plan, those are things we already have begun, and we assume that, hope that,
implore that those are included in the HEC plan, because we know that will make a difference. Progression. We provide to both of my amazing partners over here a lot of transfer students. So whether they transfer with a few credits or a year or 2 years, we are committed to making sure our students do transfer and do equal to any student that started with them as well, because that helps Oregonians. So our commitment to that, whether it's degree partnerships, and Dr. Ray knows I love our degree partnerships. I love his open campus with the community colleges. We get along extremely well, making a difference. Those things aren't embedded in the HEC plan, but it seems like they should be, because what we're already doing is the right stuff. How do you ramp up what we're doing and help us get it to full scale versus just some brand new things? Completion. Community colleges are committed to it. Sometimes our adults are not committed to it. Our adults many times come in and they want a set of accounting skills, a set of welding skills, medical terminology. They come in for a set of something that doesn't say certificate or degree. They know what they need to keep their job, get the next job. So one of the issues we have in community colleges consistently is, how do I make sure that I give Dr. Ray the one thing he wants versus the degree I'd like to give him? Not that he doesn't have already a lot of degrees. But in that process, truly, how do you do that with a person? And for many of us, we see adults walking in who want X, and our commitment is to get them to that and to keep them in their next job. Dr. Ray and I had the opportunity to be on a committee for House Bill 3418 together, and that, I don't know if you've looked at that recently, but I hope the HEC and this committee goes back and look at those recommendations, because we did a thorough review of the things we need to do next for student and institutional success that moves this pipeline, helps us get toward this Northern Star aspiration. We also worked together on the Credit for Prior Learning, on the state put together dual credit standards. So for our community colleges and universities to offer dual credit, you had to pass state standards to do that, aligned with national standards. We have so many things we have done together. So we're looking forward to working with the HEC, embedding those things we are doing and bringing them up to scale so we can really meet the kinds of goals that we're after together.
Good morning, Chair Harker, Vice Chair Huffman. I'm Ed Ray, President of Oregon State University. I'm very happy to have a chance to talk to you. I'm going to take a little bit different tact. I read the draft, the February 9th draft of the strategic plan for the HEC, and I wanted to offer you and them some observations. I've provided some written testimony. I've sent some comments to Ben and to Tim, and I guess by way of introduction, that ought to tell you that we are very, very fortunate to have Tim and Ben in the leadership positions that they're in. They reach out to people. They ask them what they think. They send us documents. They ask us for feedback. You see evidence that they heard what you had to say and react to it. They are terrific people. Representative Greenleck, I grew up in New York, so I know cynical in spades. So it's always good to ask about aspirations.
I went to Ohio State, too. So
there you go. So I know cynical in spades, and I understand when you ask, you know, do you really think you're going to reach 40-40-20? But, you know, I would ask back, do you really want someone in charge of this effort who doesn't believe in 40-40-20, who's cynical? Is it aspirational? Yes. Will we get there in 2025? I don't know. It'd be great if we got there in 2050. Given where we are. But if you don't have someone who has a passion and drive to do everything they can to get us as close to where we want to get to as fast as we possibly can, you're never going to succeed. So I think we have two really great people. I've read their plan. I think it's a great first step in setting the foundation for what I think could be a very good five-year plan. Tim mentioned that, in fact, it sort of lays the groundwork and really is an action plan for the first year, but then talks about what they could do beyond that. I think that the values that are reflected in their major objectives, broadening the pathways to accelerate progress to 40-40, the top two elements that they have oversight responsibility for to make pathways, accessible, affordable, and supportive for students, to steer higher education, to cheer the promotion of college completion and career readiness. I think the cheering part is the how do we get the funding. I think they're going to be looking to you and other members of the legislature and the governor to help all of us figure out what we can do. And I guess, you know, I don't say this enough. First of all, thank you all for your service. What you do is wonderful on behalf of the people of Oregon. Life is a lot easier when you got lots of resources to distribute. It's pretty hard when you got to make hard choices. You've been faced with hard choices since I got here almost 11 years ago, and I know that you're doing the best you can, and I know that you all care about higher education, but I want you to assure you we understand there's a lot to life beyond what we have a passion and have devoted our careers to, and you've always got to consider all the trade-offs and make some very hard choices. But we hope going forward we can all do better with respect to education. One of the things that I don't see reflected enough in the early draft of the strategic plan is that focus on Oregonians. The reason we want a seamless pre-K-20 in Oregon is not so that the workforce reflects 40-40-20, whether it's in the margin or on average by 2025 or 2040. It's so that Oregonians are at the heart of it. And I think as the HEC thinks about how they're going to deal with issues of funding and so forth going forward, there needs to be great attention to, so what piece of the action do Oregonians actually own? And so I know they'll pay attention to that, but it's worth pointing out. I want to also mention, and they talked about the pipeline, there are leaks, there is throughput, you worry about the speed things move. Connie and I were not just on the House Bill 3418 committee, but she and I co-chaired with Mary Spilde from Lane Community College, the post-secondary quality of education model group several years ago. We talked about, I think several of you, certainly Vice Chair Gallegos, asked about specific things you're going to do to get things, to get better results. Business as usual isn't going to cut it. We made lots of recommendations out of that group. More recommendations came out of 3418. Tim Nesbitt, through his involvement on the OUS board for many years, over the last 10 years, he participated in discussions in both of those groups. He's aware of all of the proposals that are out there to get better results, more, better, faster with respect to educational attainment. So I know they're going to be paying attention to that. But we need to pay attention to what we are doing that works. Connie mentioned this. I asked Bob Karen, who does the statistics for OUS, you know, we were talking about how many students do you think we need in higher education, public higher education, in 2025 if we're producing among graduates a 40-40-20 profile. And at the time, originally, he estimated 162,000 students. We now have about 106. So I said, well, what about if we raised our average six-year graduation rate from 60% to 70%? That'd be a hell of an accomplishment. And it's not impossible. I said, what would that do? And he said, well, that would make it about 142,000. And more recently, he's estimated about 138,000. Well, that's great. But you know what? That's 32,000 more students than we have now. And the issue of how we're going to educate them, how we're going to have the facilities, the teaching staff, the wherewithal to educate them, even as we're doing a better job with the dollars we have, is not obvious. So we need to make sure we're paying attention. Obviously, it's become very voguish to talk about buying outcomes. We want to buy outcomes, but if you don't have anyone in the seat, you're not going to get any outcome. So we need an appropriate balance between supporting enrollment and supporting the numbers of students who are there. And just while I'm on that theme, let me just stick with that for a few moments. Our enrollment growth this year, at OSU, 1,667 students. Enrollment growth in OUS, all seven, 1,681. There are 14 new students at the other six universities. And that's despite the fact that OIT had an increase of about 413 students. So they're seeing some real progress. But what bothers me even more, I want to go back to this business about Oregonians. Our enrollment of Oregonians was up 408 students this year. 408 students. But in fact, if you look at the combined OUS universities, this is enrollment of Oregonians is down 638 Oregon undergraduate students. We are educating fewer Oregon undergraduate students this year than last year. And, you know, it's maybe a bad image to propose, but it doesn't seem to me that you can, by digging a hole, you're going to get to the North Star. I mean, I'm directionally challenged typically, but I think that's not going to work very well. So we need to think about a lot of strategies, new things to try, but also to pay attention to enrollment and particularly pay attention to Oregonians. We need to pay attention to other things. I mean, one of the things I don't like about 40-40-20, I like the laser-like focus, but it's not all about enrollment. It's not even all about graduation. I tell people that our most important contribution to the future is our graduates. We want them to be able to compete with anyone, anywhere, anytime. We want them to be great at their careers. We have a lot of success we can demonstrate, but we want them to give back and make a difference in their communities and the world around them. We also want many of them to go on and take positions in research organizations, in private industry, in universities, and help us invent a future that gives us a comparative advantage relative to the rest of the world. And so we need to make sure that as we're talking about outcomes for the workforce, we're also creating the new businesses and jobs, the innovations that will be needed to employ these highly skilled people that we're graduating. And just to give you a quick sense of where we are, last year we brought in $263 million in research grants and contracts. We signed 108 new licensing agreements, which generated $8 million in royalties. That represents an 84% increase in 1 year. We are really focusing on university industry partnerships. It's an important part of what we do. We had $31 million last year in industry-sponsored research. That's part of what we do as a research-intensive university. We also have the responsibility for overseeing the statewide public services extension, the experiment stations, the forest research labs. Last year, they generated almost $80 million in research grants and contracts. They also, if we try to estimate their economic impact, had a $180 million impact on the economic benefits that Oregonians receive. They created nearly 2,000 family wage jobs, and for every state dollar that goes into the statewides, they generate $10 through federal grants, contracts, other kind of support that they get. So as we're thinking about higher education, we're focused on the skill profile of our graduates that leads us to think in terms of 40-40-20. We need to not lose sight of these other dimensions of what universities do and make sure we find the right balance. And finally, this goes back to Representative Greenlick's question about how do we, you know, is this a pipe dream or what is it? Let me give you some very sobering statistics, and I saw these first in the Treasurer's report where he was positioning a case for more opportunity, Oregon Opportunity Grant money. We're 47th on the downside, not 50 is the bottom, not the top. We're 47th among the 50 states in support per student FTE in public higher education, 47th. The resource allocation model, I think you heard it mentioned, that it's the basis by which dollars get slotted, cost of degrees to help public higher education. Those cells are funded at about 37% of what the costs of public higher education, we think, can be reasonably estimated at. And we're at about 43rd in the nation in state support in terms of financial aid per student FTE. So I'm all for being creative and innovative in the ways in which we fund and incent and prioritize in education. I got a life of practicing economics. I get it. I can give you lots of ideas. But I think, you know, understanding the hole we're in and making sure we focus on getting resources, even for the seemingly mundane ways in which we've been supporting higher education in the past, would not be a bad idea. I love it when people talk about cost effectiveness, efficiencies, better resource management, making the hard decisions on reallocation. We're at 37% of funding required per student FTE out of the state. We need to not just figure out how to move the chairs on the deck. We need to figure out how do we actually infuse a lot more resources into higher education if we're going to get the results that we want. So let me stop there and let my colleagues speak.
Yes, Rip Greenlee, we are really short on time.
But I need to put something on the record about this 40-40-20, and especially with Ben still here. This isn't about cynicism. Mm-hmm. I believe it is structurally impossible, for a variety of reasons, and I'll be happy to talk about them, why we can't achieve 40-40-20. And if I've learned anything in my years of life on this planet, it's if something can't possibly happen, it's not likely to. So what are the consequences? The consequence in my mind is that we need to take this as a wonderful metaphor and to be measured against as we're moving along. But we need to make sure the priority decisions are aimed at those things that are going to move us further toward this metaphor, rather than believing we can get, for example, every single person, every single adult in the state with a high school diploma. And we need to be careful what guides our priorities in the use of that metaphor, and that's the only point that I'm making.
Yeah, and if I could respond, Representative Greenlee, I've thought about this, and you know, when I came, we're in the third version of our strategic plan we're about to launch, and when I came, I talked to people about what aspiration do we have, and we set a goal for ourselves that we want to be a top 10 land-grant university. Do you know what we are now? Maybe 25th? Will we ever get to 10? I honestly don't know. I told people it could take 20, 30 years if we were lucky. We may never get there, but you know what happened in the meantime? We've raised, in our first university-wide campaign, $1 billion in support for the university. 40-40-20 is not just about hitting the mark. It's about setting people's expectations and aspirations higher and getting the kind of passion and dedication.
But you didn't say you were going to get to that top 10 by 2020.
No, but it's about getting people like Ben and Tim to devote the passion and dedication they can give. We will be a lot better off with their efforts aiming for 40-40-20 than if we're not. It's not a fool's errand. I don't know how close we can get, but I thank God we have people who aim very, very high. It's just a difference of opinion.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it is, actually.
All right. Hi, Larry.
To be continued.
Larry.
All right, there we
let's
go.
Close us out here.
All
I
right,
think.
Larry Large. I'm president of the Alliance of Oregon's Private Colleges and Universities. And we have, as most of you already know, we contribute in present practice, present metrics, 30% of that first bucket of 40. We see ourselves as contributing partners to the process of 40-40-20. And to your point, Representative Greenlee, my presidents look at this as 2025 is the first opportunity that we're going to have to renew our commitment to the underlying principles and goals of 40-40-20. We aren't likely to get there, and I'm not sure we can sustain our 30% of that process as the capacity reasons, but there's a good chance that we can, and we're working very hard on trying to contribute to the state's interest in that, because our interests are fully aligned with what the state's interests are. You think our private colleges are going to flourish if there's not a good public school system, not a good public higher education system, and not a good economy? No, we're fully aligned with that. And I want to nod toward Ben Cannon and his and Tim and the commissioners of Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Ever since their creation out of the is beginning in 2012, when the prior commission was in place, the private colleges have been invited to be at the table. That's where we can best make our contribution, is be in that discussion. We're a little more nimble, we have more flexibility at times, but we can contribute some good ideas, and we can learn as well from the conversations that are going on. To be very clear, I serve on the Credit for Prior Learning Subcommittee. I serve on the Financial Aid Award Working Group. I have people this morning over in Corvallis meeting with the STEM Council, which is a subcommittee of the Oregon Educational Investment Board, putting our metrics out there, showing that we are contributing our fair share of the STEM graduates as well. And there's not time today, but we can share those metrics at some point, maybe in the future. We care a lot about this, and we want to be at that table. I wrote a letter to the new Higher Education Coordinating Commission when it was formed, and there's clear and wonderful response of accepting the ideas and working with it. It's that kind of interaction with what you might think of as the private colleges serving the purpose of an industry cluster. We're out there contributing to the public interest, and we have an economic impact. And you talk about a good return on investment. I'm an economist also. We end up with less than one half of 1% of the state's investment in higher education, or in education, and we're producing 30% of that first bucket of 40. That's a pretty good investment. A little time, a little idea here and there. We learn from, and we grow from it, too. I don't want to make it sound like it's an all one-way proposition. There are a couple of things that I think we need to do, because I lean into this plan. I think it's the right direction that's going. We got the right people involved with it. But there are a couple, three things I think we still need to work on over time. One of those is to appreciate the distinction, and Ed will, and so will Connie, the distinction between price and cost. What we talk about when it's the burden on the student oftentimes is price. But what we have not done as an industry, it's not unique to Oregon, we haven't looked at where is that money being spent. And I'm not suggesting that we're spending it in the wrong places, but I think there's a very weak level of public understanding about how much of it goes into things like services, technology, about regulation, all of the different kinds of things. It's not all just in the instructional models. We have work to do on that, but actually that's not been the most accelerating cost curve on any of them. So without getting into the details of it, we've got to look at marketing, athletics, technology, regulations, all of those things need to be a part of the discussion. The second thing, I think there's some people missing at the table. I think we need to have a little more representation from students, and I'm not just talking about a student lobby when I say that, but when we talk about achievement compacts and we talk about things, we need to have an engagement from the students where their investment is felt, recognized, and contributes to the efficiencies of higher education. You need good data to do that. There were references in the slideshow where we have to increase our collection and the right data, the right utilization of it, and the right strategic decisions that come out of it. We've got a lot of work to do on those issues. So it's one of the things I put in the letter to HEC was, if you don't have to see yourself, in my opinion, as the source of the innovation and the next generation of everything that's going to be new. But you have to know about it in order to differentiate between those things that are worth your time and investment and those things that aren't. So I hope they will do that. I appreciate the time here this morning with all of you. And I really want to support the work that the Higher Education Coordinating Commission is doing. Thank you.
thank you all very much. While I took a class from Paul McCracken, I'm certainly not an economist, but I greatly appreciate the perspective that you brought. I am not going to shut this committee down just yet. I want to hear from a couple more people who are here. People are free to leave if they need be. The House Democratic Caucus has been rescheduled for 10:30, not 10 a.m., so from my perspective, we have a little bit of leeway there. Rep. Kaufman, you have a question or comment?
Let's go.
I got thinking about this at Duncan Weiss's meeting that we had in Portland a couple of weeks ago on higher education, and I want to encourage Ben, and I know I'll never see the slide to do this, but I want to encourage him to do it anyway. It's all about the student. So when I see 40-40-20, I'd like to see student-40-40-20-student. So we have student on each end of that so that we remember it's all about our customer.
Absolutely.
It's all about the student. Period. And as far as 40-40-20, I heard a guy say years ago, it's better to shoot for a star and hit the side of a barn than shoot for the side of the barn and hit a fence post.
Wow, that must be playing condom.
I'll leave you with that.
All right. Okay. Other questions or comments for this distinguished panel? No? Okay. Thank you all very much for
thank
being
you very
here
much
for bringing the fire. In case we thought we didn't have anything to do. Two other people are signed up. We have Hans Bernard and Debbie Koreski. And if you could keep the remarks somewhat brief, that would be great. I know. We wanted to hear from you, and thanks for being here and sticking with us.
Good morning, Chair Hawker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Debbie Doris Koreski, and I'm the Director of State Government Relations at Portland State University. So I will keep my remarks very brief. I have three things. One is that up until this point, and we assume that this will continue, the HEC has been very, very, very collaborative with the universities at, and the professionals at Portland State, the students at Portland State, about seeking our input about how to develop the strategic plan. And so that, I think that that's led to a good strategic plan. The second point is that I think we would echo the comments of President Ed Ray and hope that the HEC, as soon as they develop the capacity, would also take an interest and a focus on the economic development and the research missions of Oregon's universities and include that in the strategic plan. And then the third thing is that, and this also is from the event that was held in Portland that Representative Huffman attended, is that one of the comments that I really walked away with from the Lumina Foundation at that meeting was that as we move to more outcomes-based budgeting and change those things, is that to not fall under an apples-to-apples comparison when you look at educational institutions, because they're not apples-to-apples. They're apples and oranges and bananas, and you want them to be. And so I think for Portland State, where, you know, we don't fall into that, our students don't fall into that model of traditionally, you know, what most people think about as a university student. You graduate from high school. You start college as a freshman at 18. You graduate in 4 to 5 years. You know, our students don't look like that. Our students start at Portland Community College or Clackamas Community College. They take a year off to work and resave up money. Then they come into Portland State. They go to school part-time. They finish raising their kids. They wait for their kids to graduate from middle school and into high school so they can drive, and then they come back and finally finish, or you know, whatever their personal story is. So, and to not lose sight of that student who, although may not go to school in that traditional way, still contributes to the 40-40 goal, still improves their life, and to not discount that pathway to higher educational achievement. So, how's that for brevity?
Well done. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Harker, members of the committee. For the record, Hans Bernard with the University of Oregon. President Godfredson sends his regrets that he is unable to be here this morning. What I was asked to convey is a similar to the remarks of other speakers, a thank you to the HEC for their collaborative approach to date. There has been an enormous amount of communication with members of the HEC to the campuses, both formal and informal, and I think it has set us off on a really good path to working together as we continue to retool higher education and post-secondary delivery in Oregon. The ongoing challenge I think we face from an institutional perspective as it relates to working with the higher education is really in parsing the boxes that we've been looking at for so many years in terms of what is a function of coordination and what is a function of governance. And that after the long approach to passing Senate Bill 270 is something that at the University of Oregon we're keeping a very close eye on and want to be in constant conversations with the HEC on in terms of what are the authorities of the new governing board versus what is the coordination and the steering of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. The University of Oregon fully embraces the approach that has been put forward so far in terms of steering and cheering, and we look forward to working with the HEC to respond to the direction that they provide and the coordination and guideposts that they provide, as well as working with them to really cheer the post-secondary enterprise and come to the legislature and talk about what increased investments in post-secondary education would mean. For the University of Oregon in particular, we are excited to have a conversation about changing or looking at potentially shifting our funding model in the way post-secondary education is funded in this state, really around those key guideposts that are set by the HEC in terms of access, completion, and other issues that the commission has outlined as key priorities at this point. So I'll keep it brief and happy to respond to any questions, but I would say that in terms of this hearing and this interaction, what backs it up is an enormous amount of communication to and from all of the campuses and all the entities that have testified with you today to the HEC, letters, lots of meetings, lots of conversations, and I think that we'd be happy to share the nature, tenor, and tone of any of those at any point. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. I know that Rep. Gallegos has a question or comment, and maybe some others.
I want to make sure that my comments are seen as critique rather than criticism, and because I really do see the challenge in this endeavor. One observation, though, that I want to make, though, is that I hear a lot from administrators and from students, and I'd like to hear from faculty. Certainly when we increase the enrollments, I mean, their ramifications are clearly for faculty, larger class sizes, shrinking office space, greater advising roles, and those kinds of things that again need to be factored in, and I'm sure they are, but I'd like to hear from faculty.
I'll just close with thanking you all again for being here and for keeping the lines of communication open, and I will echo what I've heard here. I feel very fortunate having all of you, Mr. Cannon, Mr. Nesbitt, and all of you in the positions you're in and working so hard toward. Well, Rep. Huffman is gone, but taking care of the students. All right. Thank you very much. Rep. Greenland? Oh, okay. So now we are recessing.
You can close the public hearing.
I'm going to close. Thank you. I'm going to close the informational hearing on the HEC strategic plan. I am not going to close this. I am going to recess.
Until further notice.
Sometime today, we hope, maybe tomorrow. Thank you very much.